Welcome to Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And I have another great couple guests lined up today. And I also want to state that this is, I already stated the call letters, KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And please catch the programs in the archives at www.givemesometruth.info. And Dennis Fecho is my first guest here, and we're going to bring up Scott Onstott as well. And so I will dial him in here in just a second. And in the meantime, Dennis Fecho is known as The Fetch, and he's the author of The Illuminatus Observer, which is regarded by many as simply the finest Hermetic Kabbalah blog in all of blogdom. His site reaches tens of thousands of readers monthly who come for his unique Kabbalistic perspectives of English, the universal language spoken over 690 million people worldwide. He's also the host of a popular streaming radio show, Inside the Eye Live, which can be heard every Saturday from 10 a.m. to 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Central Daylight Time on Oracle Broadcasting. The Fetch brings weekly insights on geopolitics, Zionism, conspiracy history, finance, Middle East politics, and news and views that shed light on our contemporary reality. Inside the Eye Live is truly intelligent media for the politically aware. And he also happens to be, precedes my program on Saturdays, which is Truth Quest as well on Oracle Broadcasting. So, hello, Dennis, are you there?
I am here. I hope I am live on the air from Amman, Jordan. We forgot to mention that.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And while I'm at it, I'm going to go ahead and bring up Scott here. So let me go ahead and bring him in here. So we'll probably hear that call, hopefully. Hope it works out because he's in Canada.
You know, modern technology, Mel, is fascinating. I'm sitting here in Amman, Jordan. We just finished morning prayers about 10 minutes ago. I'm patched into Salida, Colorado, and now we're trying to reach somebody in
Hello.
Upper...
Hello, Scott.
Yes.
This is Melody and Dennis. So we are live on the radio, and I've already introduced Dennis, and so I'm going to let Dennis introduce you. So and then we'll go ahead and get on with the program here. But before I say this again, the views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guests, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. So, Dennis?
Yeah, and Scott, welcome.
Thank you, Dennis.
Yes,
yeah,
thank you. Welcome.
Yeah, for those who aren't familiar with Scott Onstott is received his Bachelor of Arts degree in architecture from the University of California at Berkeley in the early 90s. He later went on to teach CAD/CAM design and other computer aided programs, and through this process he's learned quite a bit on how to really disseminate information, and he's gone on and into some private research into the, let's just say, the secret numerical and political components of sacred architecture around the world, to include things as Hollywood, the Great Pyramid, Washington D.C., Baalbek. And he is the author of the site Secrets in Plain Sight. He has two videos out, Secrets in Plain Sight Volume 1 and Secrets in Plain Sight Volume 2. And his website is secretsinplainsight.com. And Scott, welcome to Truth Quest.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
How'd I do? I kind of ad-libbed that one. How'd that sound?
I think that was one of the best introductions I've heard. Yeah, very well put together. Thank you.
You know, we're in, you know, Scott, I was just mentioned earlier, I'm in Amman. Whereabouts are you?
I'm on a remote island in British Columbia called Cortez Island. It's about 100 miles northwest of Vancouver.
And so, from what I understand, the internet up there is mainly delivered through 3G, 3.5G, and you are picking up your internet really through the new latest technology in GSM handsets.
That's right. And we used to have satellite internet, which was better than a modem, but this cellular internet is even better than the satellite because it's got less latency. So I can watch YouTube clips, for example, whereas I used to be able to do that.
Yeah, satellites, you know, it's anywhere from 6 to 8 seconds, you know, as we run our telecommunications networks from the Middle East to the United States. You know, sometimes we have to hop out of, let's say, Iraq down into Germany, and we're going to get 4 to 6 seconds, you know. So it makes putting together good voice networks quite a challenge.
And
a lot of people
don't understand. It's kind of frustrating when you click on something and you have to wait 6 seconds before anything happens, you know, sitting there twiddling your thumbs wondering, is it working? Is it not? But I find that the cellular is a little bit faster, but I do miss the wired connection that I, you know, used to have in San Francisco when I lived there. That was infinitely faster.
I can imagine. I can imagine. Here in Amman, Jordan, we have a pretty robust 3.5G, 3G network, and a lot of people do use it, and it's very expensive. But when the towers get blocked up, you'll get cut off. You won't get service for quite some time. And there's just no way I could run a radio show over what I call the stupid sticks, the little USB sticks that are used to get your internet using this service. Just would be impossible. So
Do you have metered internet in Jordan?
Yeah, guys, I don't know how it is in the States because I've been in Amman, the Middle East, for a few years now, but yes, we do have metered internet. Here in Jordan, for instance, I pay right around $30 for 20 gigabit of download between 12 p.m. to 12 a.m., and I can use as much download as I can from 12 a.m. to 12 p.m. So, Scott, I was up until after 12 o'clock downloading your latest video, Secrets in Plain Sights Volume 2.
It's a big download. It's 3 gigabytes. But that's because it's an HD.
It's a great piece. Now, people really don't know who you are. Now, you were an architecture student in Berkeley. Tell us a little bit about the School of, environmental design in Berkeley that you attended.
Well, when I went there, it was really focused on design, and it sort of didn't pay too much attention to the practical aspects of the day-to-day business of architecture. So I got to spend my time there, you know, imagining things and designing things and making scale models. And I just took one AutoCAD course during college, and it was way back in on AutoCAD Release 10. And I remember at the time I didn't really care for it. I preferred doing manual drafting.
What you're really telling us is you were at the forefront of the transition from the old paper and pencil drafting, the old blueprints, to the taken for granted, the computer-aided design.
That's right. So my first couple of jobs, I was a manual draftsman. So I drew, you know, with a pencil. So that was quite a change in the way you think. You think things through, having to learn the tools all over again. And all of the complexities associated with CAD were kind of formidable. And I met that challenge, and I was sort of in the first generation of young people growing up with that, I guess.
And you went on then to write some books about really an independent view, being a draftsman as you were, an independent view of how to actually use this technology.
That's right. I've written 9 books now on different software programs, including AutoCAD. My most recent book is called Photoshop CS6 Essentials. And the one before that I wrote was called AutoCAD 2013 Essentials. So I've written things on 3ds Max and SketchUp, and I've also released video products over the years teaching people how to use these programs. And that sort of gave me a good technical background and also lots of teaching experience. And I taught at the Academy of Art University in San Francisco for a number of years. I think I taught over 1,000 people face-to-face in the classroom. And that helped me to really learn things on a new level, you know, because when, when you're asked to teach something, you have to learn it really well. You thought you knew it before, but you really didn't. When you have to come around and explain it to someone in a clear way, well, it kind of is challenging to for anyone to...
Now, being a teacher myself in my own field, Scott, I've learned that teaching involves not just explaining it one way, but you have to explain it like 15 ways because not everybody's the same.
That's right. Everyone learns in a different way. And I find that now that I'm making movies, it's a good balance between the spoken word, which kind of goes in your left brain, and the pictures, which go in your right brain. And it sort of allows visual learners to keep up with the people that are paying more attention to the audio, and it sort of stimulates you as a whole person more when you have both modes active at the same time.
Now, you were on my show June 23rd on the Oracle Broadcasting Network, Inside the Eye Live. That show remains a fairly popular show. It's still getting a good amount of exposure, downloads on the station archives. And we learned something about you that was unique on that show, and that is many people would see you as having a handicap or some type of challenge.
Well, actually, that's true, but I'd have to say that when people meet me, they might notice that I'm missing my right hand just at the wrist. It's kind of smoothed over there, and I was born this way. But people wouldn't notice that I also have two artificial legs. I was born without my legs below the knee. But I do wear artificial legs. And, again, most people wouldn't know that unless I told you.
So, Scott, do you make yourself taller than you should be?
You know what? It's funny. I have a funny story about that. When I was in my early 20s, I was experimenting with shock absorbers kind of thing in line in the leg. Mm-hmm. And it was fantastic. It was really comfortable. But I had to get taller. They had to say, well, you're going to have to be 6'4" to accommodate these shock absorbers. And I enjoyed that for a while, but it was too awkward. I'm about 5'11 now, and I find being shorter, you know, gives you a little bit more balance. But you lose respect in people's eyes. When I notice that when you're really tall, people look up to you and they sort of give you a wider berth. So I'm probably one of the few people who have experienced being different heights as an adult.
See, that's something we learned on this show, Melody.
Right.
How'd you like that, Melody? From day to day, he can be 6'3", 6'4", or 5'11".
Unless you're a stilt walker or something, yeah, that's about the only other way that I think you're going to get to experience that.
It messes up your wardrobe, I'll tell you, though.
You know, I never thought of that. I guess it might, huh? So anyways, then you went on, really, you had a little bit of transformation in your life. You get married, and then you moved up to British Vancouver.
British Columbia. Yeah, Vancouver.
Or British Columbia. I always say British Vancouver. I did that like 6 times on my show, and I should know better. I'm from Los Angeles myself. I've been to Seattle so many times. British Columbia.
Columbia is quite an interesting word in itself. You know, Christopher Columbus, the space shuttle Columbia, the family of doves is Columba Day. And I find that it's tied in with the Pleiades also, because the word Pleiades means flock of doves. And I find that in a lot of the secrets in plain sight that I've come across, Columbus is kind of a key, shall we say. For example, there's a thing called Columbus Tower in London that they're building. And my friend Jan Tolstrup noticed that Columbus Tower in London is 8,640 kilometers from Columbus Tower in San Francisco. And 8,000 or 864 is the number of the sun, because the sun's diameter is 864,000 miles. And so I think it's it's just interesting that we have these two structures with the same name, Columbus Tower, separated by this solar number, exactly. And Columbus
now, a lot of
Tower
people,
and, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, a lot of people out there, Scott, may not understand. Let's just, I guess this is a good time to introduce the idea of gematria numbers.
Yeah.
A lot of people may not understand what that is, but before we get into that, you know, you've gone on to produce two videos now. One you offer for free on the internet, that is Secrets in Plain Sight, Volume 1.
And of course, that movie is almost like having two movies because it's 3 hours and 45 minutes long.
And how do people go about seeing that?
You can just go to secretsinplainsight.com, and I sell that, Volume 1 and Volume 2 on DVD. And you can also watch Volume 1 for free right there on my webpage if you like. It's hosted on my YouTube channel, and it's divided into 23 episodes.
And so people can take it in at their own speed.
Yeah, you can take it your own speed. The DVD is nice because you can jump around to the different chapter markers and fast forward and rewind pretty easily. But it's accessible to everyone for free as well. So that helped me to develop an audience. You know, and now I have more than a million views for Volume 1.
That's actually an impressive number, Scott.
Well, it sounds impressive, but then I look on YouTube and I see videos of tight pants, and they have, you know, 47 million views. So you just have to keep it in perspective, I guess. It's a lot of people that are, you know, self-selected. They're interested in sacred geometry and gematria and mysteries and so on, and they find me because they're putting in search terms for that.
Okay, let me say this. I've got Dennis Becho and Scott Onstott as my guests this evening. Dennis is in Amman, Jordan, and Scott is in British Columbia, right?
That's right.
Now I'm starting to doubt my ability to remember it. So anyways, we welcome them both, and we're quite a distance in placement. It's just, like you said earlier, Dennis, it's amazing what you can do with Skype these days. So I'll let you two go ahead there.
Dennis, what time of day is it in Amman right
it
now?
It is 5:14 in the morning.
Well, good morning. It's,
yes, thank you.
In the evening here where I am.
Yeah, what I did, I actually set the alarm, guys. I went to bed at about 11:30 at night, 11:45. I was tired anyway, so I actually went to sleep very fast. Set the alarm for 4:45. Actually woke up without the alarm at 4 o'clock, and then got some coffee and got myself ready and tried to warm up the voice a little bit and chased the cats out of the house because they're everywhere. And
when you look at the clock, do you often see times like 4:44? Is that something?
No,
that
I do see 11. I am one of those guys that sees 11:11 all the time, and I'll see 3:14.
A pie, right? Okay.
Yeah, I'll see 3:14. I'll see 11:11. I'll see 7:22, which
that's
is again is
pie.
Now, guys, to those of in the audience out there, a little bit introduction about myself and Scott. I'm a Hermetic Kabbalist. I deal in the esoteric codes within the English language, and the English language is basically a hyperdimensional representation of pi. You can find my work at the illuminatusobserver.blogspot.com. It's quite comprehensive. It reaches tens of thousands of people every month. And, of course, I've gone on and to do my radio show at the Oracle Broadcasting Network. Now, what's interesting about Scott is taking the same information, essentially, that I have put and deciphered in the English language, but Scott is deciphering this information in architecture around the world. Scott, that's basically what you are doing now with Secrets in Plain Sight. Is that correct?
That's right, especially in Volume 1. And in Volume 2, I'm getting sort of going a bit beyond architecture and finding these codes in the solar system and in the quantum scale and in other places. So I started with architecture because that's my background. And mm-hmm. I've noticed lots of patterns in architecture. And starting to notice them in harmonies in the cosmos. And so it's sort of everywhere. It's as above, so below, the Hermetic motto, if you will.
Correct. Now, one of the primary start points is in what we call gematria numbers. You want to go ahead and give your definition of gematria numbers for everybody out there?
Well, okay. I would say that gematria is the, you look at language and you can assign numbers to letters. And then you can add up the numbers within a word, and that can give you a code. And then you can compare words using that code, or even you can compare phrases, and they might have the same gematria value. And so it's a way of understanding language. And beyond that, there are certain important numbers. Like I mentioned, 864 before, and that ties in with the sun. And it ties in with the number of seconds in a day. There's 86,400 seconds in a day. And it ties in with many other things besides. But when you start researching number and how these things fit together, you start coming across certain numbers which seem to be magnets or something, where disparate phenomena seem to coalesce around certain key numbers.
And this is what we refer to as gematria numbers. Yeah, 33, 6.
Is very important.
Actually, gematria numbers, you know, if people aren't familiar, it's one of the guys that talked a lot about this and did a very good job is The Code by Carl Monk. And he teaches well how the fractals work, where we have the 6, the 6, 6, the 6, 6, 6, the 6, 6, 6, 6. And, of course, these are all in multiples. And if we look at the English language and we shift our alphabet at Q, we will then see that the A and the Q, of course, would line up. The B and R become the same shape. The C and the S are the hissing sounds. They will be at number 3. The D and the T, which are both dentals, will be at 4. E and U will be the same. In other words, we'll say the, but E takes on the U sound. F and V are the labials. They'll be at 6 and so forth. And we're actually able to encode gematria numbers very efficiently using this phonetic code into English. You know, sun would have a number like S is 3, N is 5. So the sum of 1 to 6 is 21, which is the U letter. So sun really is nothing but a code for 365 days. And these numbers will appear quite often in architecture around the world. For instance, the Great Pyramids. What are some of the gematria numbers you have found inside the Great Pyramids, Scott, within your research?
Well, a lot of my research is reading books and sort of synthesizing lots of other people's research. And I'm careful to give everyone credit. And I believe it was Graham Hancock who pointed out that the number 432 is encoded in the Great Pyramid.
Now, this would then be a gematria number, Scott. Why? Because it's a fractal. It's a half of the 864.
That's right. There's actually a whole sequence there. It starts at 54, and it goes to 108, 216, 432, 864, 1728, and finally 3456. And all of these numbers are really important in different ways. But in the Great Pyramid, if I can remember right, I think it's the perimeter of the base times 43,200 equals the equatorial circumference of the Earth in feet. I believe it's feet. It might be miles. I'd need to calculate that. And the number 43,200 times the height of the Great Pyramid equals the polar radius of the Earth in the same unit. It's either feet or miles. I've forgotten. But that number is harmonic, essentially, and it connects the pyramid to the Earth.
Now, 864 is regarded, though, as the number of the sun, and that is because traditionally the number of the sun was 864,000 miles in diameter. And for those not familiar, that is actually a factor of 6 times 6 times 6 times 4 times 1,000. And 666 being, of course, known as the number of the sun. And that is from the magic matrix of the sun, which is a 6 by 6 cube. You want to discuss that a little bit, Scott?
I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to, but the six, are you saying six times six times six? Being the
yes, it's 216. Yeah,
so there's a crop circle that just happened a couple of days ago, and it's like a cube in isometric, and each face is divided into six squares, and so you have each face is six times six or 36 squares, mm-hmm. and there are six faces in a cube, so there are 216. Squares on the surface of this crop circle cube, and six is really the number of the cube, because if you look at a cube in isometric, you see, what do you see, Dennis?
You tell me. I'm not a geometry guy.
You see a hexagon.
I see. Okay.
And the moon's diameter is 2,160 miles.
Correct, which is then again the 666.
Yeah, and you know, when I say these things, you go ahead and look it up on Wikipedia, and you'll see that it's very slightly off. It's like 2,158 miles or something like that.
Correct. Yeah,
and with all of these things, there's always a 0.1 or 0.001 or something like that, a very tiny fraction that's off. And I think that's really just the difference between the ideal and the real. You know,
yeah, and we also call that in gematria a rule of Kollel. There's always a slight shift, usually by a factor of one or so, and then
are you allowed to have you're add or subtract
actually allowed
one?
To shift? Yeah, you're allowed to shift. So if we take the word dios and we use the summation of the word dios, 4 is 10, I is 9, which is 45, because we're using the summation of the letter, and you add it all up, it equals 366. So Dios then becomes like a factor of the sun, but it's a shift of one, where in sun,
you know what,
Dennis,
365. 366 is also very related to the Earth cycle, because it's the number of rotations in a sidereal year. That is, from star to star. Sidereal means star. So believe it or not, there are 366 rotations of the Earth in a year. And that's because the day is actually slightly less than 24 hours. I can't remember the exact number. I think it's 236 seconds or something less than 24 hours. And over the course of the year, that adds up to a day. So 366, in my opinion, is right on. You don't even have to add or subtract one.
So Dios is more accurate than sun in this case.
It resonates with
as an actual number, Dios being 366 and sun being 365.
It resonates more with the star timing of the Earth rather than what's the other term? Sidereal and
synodic.
Synodic. Yeah. There you go.
Yes.
Yeah. Synodic.
Yeah. Right. Now, like the synodic orbit of Venus is 225 days, and using again gematria. The letter V is 225, the letter E is 5, or the letter V is 22 and the letter E is 5. So VE is 225, and that's the number of days in the synodic orbit of Venus, where then we could see that the code is just, the word is just basically embedding this code. VE is 225 and NUS is sun in reverse, NUS is SUN. So this is a case where the word is clearly telling you what the astronomical coding of this planet is.
That's very interesting. And, you know, the term Lucifer is sometimes, it actually literally means the light bringer or the planet Venus. And so here we have a connection between sun and Venus in the word Lucifer. I think that's fascinating. You just explained how VE is connected with the reverse of sun. Nuss.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, there's so much to do with Herm's Thoth. If you look at Herm's Thoth and the way that when it transits the sun, you'll have 3.14 transits per year.
Is that right? Interesting.
Yes. So you'll have basically a pi. Mercury, when we view it from Earth, transits the sun, and its transits is literally 3.14, 111 days. and then it'll make something like 22 transits over the span of 7 years, which then returns us then of the fractal 22 over 7. And, of course, it's from Hermes that we get the sacred word, and the sacred word is pi. And that, of course, is instrumental, Scott, in architecture around the world.
That's right.
Now, going back to the 864, people really don't understand how prevalent this number is in architecture, but you really identified a lot of places that have 864. I believe from our last show, one of those was the Transamerica Tower.
Yeah, the Transamerica Pyramid is it's 853 feet high, but if you include its glass pyramidion and mast, it's another 11 feet. That brings it up to 864.
And then
so it's really like an obelisk resonating with the sun. And I found that it also fits into a larger secret architecture of San Francisco, in that it's one of the endpoints of this nine-sided polygon, an enneagon, that fits over the streets of San Francisco. And it also, that same enneagon locates Treasure Island, which is in the middle of the San Francisco Bay. One of the edges of that nine-sided figure defines exactly the location, orientation, and length of the long side of Treasure Island. And so it's this amazing kind of resonance there. And there, it just goes to many levels deep.
It makes you think a little bit of conspiracy there, where these people knew what they were doing. They were playing with the geometry. When they called it Treasure Island, the treasure is in the harmonics of the numerics that they have put down. It makes you kind of wonder what they're doing.
The same architect who designed the Transamerica Pyramid, his name is William Pereira. And I believe it was completed in the early 70s. And around that same time, he built another structure in Southern California in a place called Laguna Niguel, which was the town where I grew up. And this building...
Very close to my hometown. I used to go to Laguna Niguel quite often.
Okay. Well, I actually learned to drive a stick shift in the parking lot of this particular building that Pereira designed. It's called the Ziggurat. And I didn't know this until maybe a year ago. But I went in Google Earth, and I was checking it out because it's a ziggurat shape, which I found very interesting. And I discovered that its location on the Earth is at 33 degrees, 33 minutes, and 33 seconds north. So I thought, this is no accident, because I happen to know that that building was built out there right around the time I was born. And it was really in the middle of nowhere in those days. You had to drive kind of over the hill and out in the middle of nowhere to go to this place, and everybody was wondering, what are they doing? It's this giant federal building, well away from all the other developments. And, of course, now, 40 years later, the suburbs have filled in all around it, so it's no longer in the middle of nowhere. But I'm convinced that that William Pereira must have carefully selected this site because of its geographic coordinates.
And it's quite common for secret systems to encode their knowledge in architecture. People aren't familiar with that, but if you look at Washington, D.C., it's a great example. Again, going back to Washington, D.C. and these sacred numbers, you found 864 in other places, have you not?
I have, yes. I found it also in the area of the Place de la Concorde, the largest square in Paris. It's 86,400 square meters. So here we have square meters. Some people are like, well, that's a different unit. It's not miles.
But it's correlative.
I find that it's the numbers that matter, not
correct,
the units. The units actually are a trip in themselves, and I'm writing this book right now called Structures of Reality, and I go into lots of the different unit systems and show how they're all based on amazing things, that you wouldn't expect. And so the meter, for example, is, contrary to popular belief, a sacred measure. If you're interested, I can tell you more, but...
Sure.
Well, let me just cut in here just for a second and state that I have Dennis Fecho as my guest today and Scott Onstott, and we're talking about I can't even say the word, so I'm going to let you say that. But in the meantime, Dennis is in Amman, Jordan, and Scott is in British Columbia. So we're talking about the geometries and mathematics and Kabbalah and is it gematic? Is it
gematria?
Okay.
Gematria.
Yes. Okay.
It's actually a Greek term. It comes out of the Greek. It's basically then absorbed into Hebrew literature in a very big way. It disappears from the West purportedly. It resurfaces as Hebrew, but the reality is that gematria, sacred encoding, using numbers in words, has always been a mainstay of Western mysticism. It's just not spoken about. That's the interesting thing, and same as what you're looking at, Scott. These numbers are being coded everywhere in architecture, but nobody's really talking about it. They're not bragging about it.
That's right. These architects don't publicize the fact that they're encoding these numbers in their structures, and I wonder whether they're conscious of it or not. And certain things seem... for sure, they're conscious of it. But in other cases, especially with alignments and distances which connect ancient monuments, I wonder if it isn't some sort of deeper issue at play here. I'll give you an example. The distance from the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, which is a very holy place, sacred to three of the world's religions, the distance from there to Stonehenge is 33.33 degrees. And this one just really blew my mind when I measured it in Google Earth. Because, these are both really ancient things. And to believe that that's some kind of conspiracy just kind of seems far-fetched to me.
Yeah, another interesting thing, too, to the listeners out there, again, we talk a lot about the use of fractals in the language, fractals in the geometric encoding. And so when Scott says 33.33, again, when we look at the great year of Plato, which is 25,920 years, it's a factor of 6 times 6 times 6 times 6 times 20. And that will give you the actual... time, correlative time of the Earth's wobble in space as it goes on its, as it spins on its axis, because it's also wobbling like a top. And that wobble is called the Great Year, or the Platonic Cycle, or the Precession of the Equinoxes, or 25,920 years. So when you see a number like 33.33, well, we would just sum the threes. 1 plus 2 plus 3 is 6. So therefore, that's just it's a type of 66.66, which is encoding the precession of the equinoxes. And Scott, that really is another number that is very strongly encoded in architecture. Do you have any examples that you can share?
Of 666, you mean?
Not 666, but 12th, the great year, Platonic cycle, 25,920 or 12,960. It's fractal.
I don't have one on the top of my head here, but I know there are examples like that.
Between Jerusalem and Stonehenge. That's a good start.
Yeah, because I thought you covered that in your movie, but maybe not.
Well, I did talk about the Great Year. Certainly.
Okay.
Yeah, the great year.
I just don't have a measurement from a building that pops to mind right away.
How about between distances, between points?
I don't tend to see a lot of the great year in distances. I tend to see single repetitive digits a lot of times, like the distance from the Kaaba in Mecca to the Dome of the Rock is 666 nautical miles. For example, or the distance from the Kaaba to Baalbek, Lebanon is 777 nautical miles.
Which, again, returns us back to a gematria number, Scott, because if we take a cube, it is designed around the one, the number one is opposite to six, the number two is opposite to five, the number three is opposite of the four, which then when you add up the two sides, it's 777.
Yes.
Yeah, so a lot of this...
digits are one of the keys to understanding these things. For example, the Washington Monument is 555 feet high, and then it's all, I think it's 555 feet 5 1/4 inches or something like that. And it's just about, I think it's something like 3/8 of an inch shy of being 6,666 inches high. So,
well, I think that they probably fired the contractor for making that mistake.
I think they probably did it perfectly, but then it settled a little bit. You know?
You know, that would make sense.
It would be really hard to build something of that size and get it within 1/8 of an inch.
Well, you've done
architecture just doesn't have that kind of precision generally.
Ground sinkage, you know, I think one of the first things you guys look at as architects is the soil conditions. What are you building on?
That's right.
Are we building on hard rock, building on sand? Yeah, the building can't handle. I think they built some prisons in Los Angeles, but they didn't do a good job measuring the soil. And those things have sat empty for years and years because if they put people inside, they'll start to tilt. You know, so they spent like hundreds of millions of dollars, and these things are empty because they didn't actually factor in the condition of the soil properly.
Yeah, doesn't surprise me. You know, I mentioned some nautical mile figures.
Yes.
And the Earth's meridional circumference, that is the distance from the North Pole through the South Pole and back up to the North Pole again. That is 6 times 6 times 6 times 100 nautical miles.
So the 666 is such a key number within the observational reality of Earth. And it's funny how the number has been vilified so much within the, let's say, the Christian Hebraic traditions. But the reality is that you cannot decipher reality as it's been crafted here on planet Earth without an understanding of 666.
Yeah, and, you know, perhaps it would be helpful if people are freaked out about the number of the beast to consider that it's not just 666 that's important. It's 111 and 222 and all of the numbers that are single repetitive digits. I was looking at Los Angeles recently in Google Earth, and I was studying that. And I happened to be on a trip in Austria at the time. And a gentleman who works right there in downtown L.A. emailed me, and he said, I work at 333 South Beaudry Street, I think it is.
And I know said, that street. I know
said,
that
I,
building.
I think it might be a secret in plain sight. Can you check it out? And first of all, I was blown away that right when my attention was focused on Los Angeles, that someone in Los Angeles would contact me. This happens once in a while in my research, and I'm just blown away with the synchronicity of it. But then I was looking at L.A., and I realized, wait a minute, the building in the next block is 333 South Hope, which is the Bank of America Tower. And then there's another building right next to that, 333 in the next street, and I think that's the Wells Fargo building. And so 333 is a very popular address. And then I kept looking at that line that was sort of being traced between 3rd and 4th, I think it's 3rd and 4th streets or 3rd and 4th avenues in L.A. And that line goes straight to this thing called Angel's Flight, which is a funicular railway. It goes up a couple of blocks, you know. It's like 100 years old. And I was researching that. And then, what do you think the slope is of that railway, Dennis?
That's an interesting thing. Yeah, I know exactly where that is. I lived downtown L.A. for a number of years. What is the slope?
The slope is 33 degrees.
Yeah, it is kind of steep. You know?
I was laughing. Like, it's on this line that goes across the city, the downtown, where there's all these prominent buildings with the address 333. And here we have this Angel's Flight. And then the name of the two cars on the railway is Sinai and Olivet. And Olivet is the Mount of Olives. And so these two cars are representing these sacred mountains in all three of the Abrahamic religions. And it's just uncanny. Was this all premeditated? Or is this
surely. No, yeah, sure. Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure it's premeditated. If you go into downtown L.A., especially the library for one, but if you go just walk downtown L.A., and I used to live in downtown Los Angeles, and I thought about writing a book called L.A. on a Shoestring, meaning that just, you know, all the different sights that you could see if you were to just get into your shoes and walk. And what you can actually see by walking, like a little guide for tourists, you know, L.A. on a Shoestring. First, it would be cheap, but really it's just walking through L.A. and seeing all the sights, and you'd be amazed at the Masonic, pre-Masonic influence into Los Angeles.
I would really be interested to, you know, maybe in a private conversation or email to pick your brain about L.A. because it's something I've been doing a fair bit of research on. Did you know that L.A. City Hall is inspired by the mausoleum of Halicarnassus, which is one of the wonders of the ancient world?
This I didn't know.
And
I do know that when you have these buildings and you have like a central structure, like, and then you have like elongated wings, like is City Hall. The principle of a hall in ancient Assyrian mysticism was like the mausoleum.
Okay.
You know, it signifies Osiris's tomb.
Yes. And it's reminiscent of the House of the Temple in D.C., which is also a replica of the mausoleum of Halicarnassus. And so we have kind of a very heavy-duty Masonic connection there to the mausoleum.
And what people don't understand is we had... You know, I think Masonry at its height, and to those of you who are Freemasons out there, you know, don't send me too many emails. I know most of you don't. You're good people. But we had something at its peak, something like 5.5 million Masons strong going back in the 20s, 30s, which I think is really the peak before we saw Freemasonry start to decline rapidly through the 40s, 50s, 60s type of thing.
Yeah,
and so if
all the
you
Masons
just had
I've met are good people. You know, they're interested in generally in the mystery. Some of them are. I think a lot of them are just in it because it's a social networking venue, and you know they take it for that.
The point I want to make is that even if we had just 0.5% of these people really involved in the higher level esoteric mysteries, and coding that within, let's say, the United States. You're talking about in the tens of thousands of individuals. This is something that would be very difficult to pull off when you have a capital, human capital, in the tens of thousands of people spread across the country in positions of a power, authority, etc., all across the country. It's not something that would be a very... And as people look at this and say, oh, it would take such a conspiracy. I say, no, not really. Because if you have 40, 50,000 people actively involved, and that's just a tiny fraction or percentage of the total craft in positions of mayors. You know what I mean? Mayors, city hall, planning, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's not that difficult to pull off encoding this information within a generation to three.
Well, conspiracies are possible, but so too is synchronicity. And I don't think it's possible to say that it's all one or the other, because sometimes synchronicities do happen.
You know, I'm looking at a pin that I just happened to pick up, and I was twirling it in my hand, but it's a Radisson Hotel pin, but the number on it is 800-333-3333.
A lot of threes.
Yes, it is. Well, you guys were talking about that address, and then I just pick up the look at that. But I've got Dennis Fecho and Scott Onstott, and we're talking about the Gematria. So,
did you know the sun is 333,000 times more massive than the Earth? And
no.
Scientists at Stanford University in 2010 discovered that the sun's core rotates once every 33 days. So these are just a couple of examples of how 33 correlates with the sun. But it also correlates with the human body, because there are 33 bones in our spinal columns. And with the Earth, you have to go faster than Mach 33 to escape from Earth. That's called escape velocity. And you have to dive 33 feet under the ocean to go down one atmosphere and increase one atmosphere of pressure. Another way of saying that is that our atmosphere is equivalent to a column of water 33 feet high. So we have all these 33s. It's
and, okay. And don't forget that if escape velocity is Mach 33, and also angel's flight, which would be like escaping from the material realm because you're kind of like dead, you know, you're an angel,
yep,
is also 33 degrees.
That's a great point, Dennis. Excellent.
So, now, you've done a lot of work in your Secrets in Plain Sight Volume 2. Again, it's available on DVD. Go ahead and give that information out real quick.
Yeah, people can go to secretsinplainsight.com, and right there on the homepage, you'll see a link to if you want to buy the Volume 2 DVD. And that goes for $27.
Well, we really can't say the prices. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I won't.
That's the difference between commercial and community radio.
Okay. Well, you can find out everything about what I'm doing there at secretsinplainsight.com.
Now, to those not familiar with Scott's work, Scott does a great job putting it, as he says, he's had a lot of years teaching. If you go through First Secrets in Plain Sight Volume 1 to get an idea of what he's doing, it's available for free. Just go to his YouTube channel. Just do a web search. It's easy to find. You can, you know, click through the Illuminatus Observer if you'd like to go give my site a plug equally, and you can click through. He's there on the right sidebar. But he does a great job of explaining it in a layman's term, something that's very simple and easy to understand. If the information, the numbers are a bit intimidating, he walks you through it in a very simple way that allows you to absorb the information. So I highly recommend his work. 32, 32, 32. So we have this number 32 and 33. Again, this rule of Kollel in the, let's say, the language Gematria. 32, 32, 32. North, Babylon.
Babylon. It is exactly right in the middle of Saddam Hussein's reconstruction of ancient Babylon. And it just blew me away when I put a place mark there, and I'm like, wait, is that true? It's exactly 32 degrees, 32 minutes, 32 seconds north.
And its elevation is exactly at sea level.
Is that right?
Yes, 0 feet.
Yes.
And the interesting thing, guys, is I've actually been in Iraq. I live in Amman, Jordan. I took a trip in with some of the Special Forces guys from the Iraqi Army, not the American Army. We went in, we visited 4th Infantry Headquarters, and we actually spent one night, with the governor of Salahuddin Province, and I visited Saddam's house, his actual residence there on the Euphrates River, and you would be surprised, Scott, at the Masonic influence inside of his building, inside of his house.
Well, you know, you say Masonic, and that's a natural thing to do.
Well, no, it is a Masonic influence. It has the exact same columns that you will see on some of the Masonic buildings in Los Angeles. The exact same structures. You will see the Vesica Pisces.
I wanted to make a point here that the Masons basically are kind of like a, in my opinion, it's like an echo of an Egyptian mystery school. They're carrying some of the knowledge down.
Correct.
And there are probably other groups that have carried some of that knowledge down, like the Rosicrucians and different secret groups as well.
Well, you're right. I'm actually working on a new article about this on the occult significance of 9/11, and one of the things I'm going to be speaking about is exactly what you're talking about. Like St. Francis of Assisi, he carried down the esoteric significance of the letter T, for instance. And you'll see actually different groups throughout history are actually like carrying a secret flag, and they're essentially making sure that a particular component of this larger mystery is not lost by encoding it within their works. So Saint Francis of Assisi.
Can you tell me more about what he's encoding with T? Because Saint Francis of Assisi, of course, is who San Francisco is named after.
Well, this I didn't know. Well, basically, it's if you look at Saint Francis's work, you will see the letter T everywhere. T is kind of like his logo, his marketing campaign, but T is instrumental in the greater mysteries, because it's the seventh letter of the second half of the alphabet. It represents the solstice. The word solstice is just S-O-L-S, which is souls, meaning summer, T, and then ice, meaning winter, T. And so basically this is the sun start point, is the letter T. This becomes in the Ankh on the winter solstice. And of course, this is a traditionally pagan-wise on the 22 day of the month, 22 over 7 being, of course, the omnific word, which is pi. And so T is very instrumental. Of course, Christianity is also what? It's encoding and carrying the letter T. Everywhere it goes, you will see the T. And sometimes people don't understand that the mythologies are crafted around the actual letter you're looking at.
So does the cross have a significance then, you're talking about the T with the Christianity?
Yeah, it's all having to do with, again, this idea around pi. It's encoding pi. You know, you look at Inri, you sum up the words Inri in summation, it's 366 again. You know, it's I meaning 45, N is 105, etc. Add up those numbers, it's 366, which is the sun. Jesus is there to replace Zeus, which is another code word for sun. So it all revolves around pi and the sun. And, of course, this then gets embedded into the sacred architecture like Heliopolis. Now, when we talk about Heliopolis, Scott, you're going to have to return us back to Egypt and Baalbek.
That's right. Well, Heliopolis, the original Heliopolis was in Egypt. And then later, in another epic, Baalbek was known as Heliopolis. Is that what you're referring to, Dennis?
Correct. And where Western mysticism, Western esoteric systems are deriving from, including Lurianic Kabbalah, which is supposedly this great Hebrew learning system. In reality, it's all emanating out of the Pythagorean schools, and Pythagoras studied in where? Baalbek.
And well, he essentially learned what he learned from the Egyptian knowledge. You know, he's carrying that wisdom tradition forward, and we say, no, it's Greek. Well, the Pythagorean theorem probably was known by the Egyptians. You know, the 3-4-5 triangle is very important to the Egyptians.
And it also plays instrumental in the Baalbek Kaaba, a great pyramid structure, from what I understand. I believe you found some esoteric significance there within the 3-4-5, within this these three structures.
That's right. There, if you draw lines connecting Baalbek, the Great Pyramid, and the Kaaba, it forms a 1-2 right triangle. And one way of looking at that is it's like two squares put next to each other, and you draw a diagonal through from the one corner to the opposite corner, and then you get 1 to 2 triangles. And then if you look at that shape, that is the same proportion as the king's chamber within the Great Pyramid itself. And in volume 2, I show how you can derive pi and phi from a 1 to 2 right triangle. And so both of these numbers, which are very important mathematical concepts, are encoded in something so very simple, you know, 2 squares. It's really profound. They come right out of this geometry. And so the Great Pyramid, I think, is like the microcosm. It's as above, so below. You have this geomantic triangle, and then you look at the, and that's the macrocosm, if you will. And then you look down into the pyramid and you see the fractal replica of that at a small scale in the microcosm. So as above, so below. And there's a researcher named Cort Lindahl who connected these sites originally just by looking at the Great Pyramid. What he did is he drew a line, he looked at the Great Pyramid and realized that it's oriented almost perfectly due north, super high tolerance. So he said, well, what if I drew a line connecting the opposite corners towards the northwest, towards the northeast, and that line goes to Baalbek. And then he said, okay, well, what if I draw a line going to the southeast through the Great Pyramid's corners? Well, that line goes to Mecca, to the Kaaba specifically. And then when you...
It's really quite interesting, you know, when you look at, think about it, it's very, very interesting that it, is this synchronicity or is this really some type of planned architecture?
Well, I think if it is synchronicity, it nevertheless bears the mark of consciousness. So someone planned this at some level. But whether that was some grand Egyptian conspiracy that carried forward into the time when the Black Stone landed at that very point where they put the Kaaba, or whether this was coordinated by extraterrestrials or angels or demons, I think it's anyone's guess. But what I'm doing is just showing you that there's these incredible harmonies that happen that we're kind of struggling to explain, but nevertheless, the harmonies are there. So they deserve our attention.
Yeah, Scott, we got to hand it over to Melody. She's got an important announcement to make.
It's just that it's KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And this is Truth Quest with Melody. And my guests this evening are Dennis Vecchio and Scott Onstott. Okay,
and Scott, we were talking earlier about, again, gematria. All of this revolves around gematria numbers. To those, again, who are interested in this topic, I do recommend you go check out Karl Monk, The Code, as a primer. He does a very good job simplifying it, in my opinion. It'll give you a good primer into it. You can go out and see my work if you're looking to how this information encodes into the language at the Illuminatus Observer. If you want to see how this information is then spread out across the globe, you can go see Secrets in Plain Sight at secretsinplainsight.com. Now, one of the great gematria numbers is the circle of life, Scott. And why I say that is because if we take the Platonic cycle, okay, 6 times 6 times 6 times 6 times 6 times 6 times 10 is 12,960 years, which is what we call the pi proportion. The pi proportion was actually introduced to us in a book called Hermetic Masonry back in the 1910, 1920s, I believe, somewhere around there, by Frank Higgins. And he brought this idea called the pi proportion, saying the pi proportion is embedded in the language in many places, and it's never, ever far from the surface. You know, it's there if you look. And when we take 6 times 6 times 6 times 6 times 10, that's called a fractal because it's 12,960, which is exactly one half the period of the Platonic cycle, which is 25,920 years. In other words, if you take 25,920 years, divide it by 2, that'll give you 12,960. And this is the co-relational period in time, or the pi proportion, because it's a diameter of the Earth's wobble on its axis. Now, when we put it back into letters, now if you look at a dollar bill or a $5 bill, you'll see, oftentimes you'll see the letter A and you'll see a 1. You'll see the letter B and you'll see a 2. You'll see the letter K and you'll see an 11. Because always the letters and the numbers are interchangeable. And the letter L is 12, the letter I is 9, the letter F is 6, and the letter E, being silent, 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 is 15, which is the O letter. Hence, the word life is encoding the Platonic cycle pi proportion. And that
that's
is a six,
beautiful
six,
thing, isn't it? You know.
Yes, and this is not an accident. Trust me, guys. This is not an accident. It is the way the language was crafted. Now, Scott, you have found 666. We call that 6666 for short. You have found 6666 yards to be integral within Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. And in that, I'm talking a start point of observatory circle.
That's
which would
right.
Be like planet Earth.
The distance from the center of observatory circle in D.C., which is this big circle, and it has a diameter of 666.6 yards. So the distance from the center of that circle to the entrance of the U.S. Capitol building is 6,666 yards.
And, of course, Scott, the big circle is the Earth's wobble on its axis.
That's right. And, Dennis, when you were saying that, I realized that this half precessional cycle is, you could also say that, six ages of the great year.
Correct.
Right?
It is six ages. Yeah, because
so
there's 12 ages.
Six. Yeah.
And it's one age, guys. It's just one zodiac period, or six times 10 years is 1/12 of the zodiac.
Right.
Which is then, of course, 1/12 of the zodiac, of course, is just the wobble of the Earth's axis divided by 12. So these types of numbers you're going to find everywhere. You know, literally everywhere, if you're just willing to listen and look and peer into it. And I think that's what the work of Scott and mine are really looking to do, is saying, look what the ancients did all the way up into even our esoteric Western systems, is all about encoding this information so that it's never lost.
That encoding isn't just in architecture. You see that a lot in the corporate names and corporate logos, right?
Correct.
Right.
That's
correct.
Right, yeah.
Especially the logos, you know, especially logos quite often. Scott, real quick, what is the relationship of the United States Naval Observatory to Observatory Circle and One Observatory Circle?
Well, Observatory Circle, inside of it, you have One Observatory Circle, which is the residence of the Vice President of the United States.
Oh, I see. You know, and you can actually, guys, you have to buy this, okay? You have to go get the mad video here. But I'm looking at it. We have a giant observatory circle. Then we have a smaller one observatory circle. And then the United States Naval Observatory. So I see what you mean. So observatory circle is the center. Correct?
Well, observatory circle is the circle.
As you,
and everything
is the circle.
Within it.
So the center point is, okay, from the center point of observatory circle, you have then a one observatory circle to the northeast,
and kind of to the
United States
to the a little bit to the east, maybe a little bit south.
Yes, south and east. Yes,
as the U.S. Naval Observatory itself.
Okay, then go ahead. What is the significance? It's forming a triangle. What's the significance here, if any?
Well, it's just that the U.S. Naval Observatory is where they keep the most accurate time. And they have atomic clocks and so on, and they synchronize the time on the internet, and they also serve time to the GPS satellites. And so it's all about timekeeping.
And what few people understand is that if you do not have And this is like the really trick stuff about the internet that I can't even fathom. These guys are geniuses. But if you don't have everything atomically timed on the internet, it will never work. Because we need to know when data arrives, when it comes, when it goes, and we put it back together. So everything has a clock time, and it all goes back to this atomic clock.
That's right. And it ties in with all the sixes that we mentioned about observatory circle, in that there's a hexagon on, I think it's the north pole of Saturn. It's either the north or the south pole of Saturn. And the Voyager spacecraft photographed that. And then many years later, they sent another spacecraft up there, the Cassini spacecraft, and it also photographed it and verified that, yes, there's a giant hexagon in the cloud formations on Saturn that is permanent. It just persists, and it's a little bit larger than the Earth. And, you know, this ties right in with what we're talking about, because Saturn is the god of time. You know, Kronos.
And the cherubim is basically is a cube. And cherubim, of course, is always denoted as a baby with angel wings. So it's like
that's the young version of Father Time, right?
Yes, this is
and
yes.
Then
this
Father
becomes
Time
like
grows up and he gets his scythe and he becomes the Grim Reaper. You know, he becomes Saturn, essentially.
Right. And you have, you know, going back Washington, D.C., you know, there's a few books out there. I can't off the top of my head name them. But there's, you know, Sacred Architecture, Secret Architecture of Washington, D.C., District of Columbia. You've done quite an extensive piece in your work, Secrets in Plain Sight, Volume 2. Just south of the White House, there's a big circle. And you talk about this circle south of the White House. 366.
Which one are you referring to? Are you talking about the Pentagon there? Or
not the Pentagon. 366. Sec.
You're talking about Ellipse Park, I think, right?
Yes, that could be.
Yeah. So this is from Christopher Knight and Alan Butler. They did some research in a book called Before the Pyramids, and they show that the width of Ellipse Park is 366 megalithic yards. And they find that this number 366 is very important. And they show that the Pentagon is designed with this number also, in that the arc measure from one point of the Pentagon to the next is 366 megalithic yards. And so they're finding this connection just south of the White House and in the Pentagon. And then they did this amazing thing where they drew a triangle connecting the center of Ellipse Park with the center of the Pentagon with the Capitol Rotunda in the U.S. Capitol. And then they calculated the perimeter of that triangle, and that turns out to be 33 times 366 megalithic yards. So they're finding this incredible resonance here with 33 as well.
Or 366.
Yeah, and then they did research and showed that FDR, you know, I think he was a 32nd degree Freemason, and he was the 32nd president of the United States. And he broke ground on the Pentagon on September 11th, 1941. And it seems like, you know, this was all planned. It was planned somewhere by somebody, because you just don't get these type of perfect measurements randomly, you know? So
correct.
My point is that it bears the mark of consciousness. And whether it was a Freemasonic conspiracy or whether it was a synchronicity that was executed at a more subtle level, or I can't say. I don't know.
You know. Well, you're talking about perfect geometry, Scott. Come on. How can this be how can this be synchronistic, you know? I just want to add one point, because to those who are, you know, my radio show, Oracle Broadcasting, every Saturday, 10 o'clock a.m. to 12 p.m., we deal in some of these conspiracy issues, conspiracy history, history that you're not going to get. In other words, we're not mainstream media. We have a very good education, insight into what's going on in the world. We share that with the listener. And unfortunately, Scott, within our business, meaning I'm not about the alternative media business. There's lots of fear mongering out there. And what I would like people to know as you listen and review information like Scott gives or I provide, you know, just because there's information out there that seems well beyond what you're familiar with at a layman's level, doesn't make it evil. And a good way to compare that is, look, you know, you don't need to know what it took to make a bridge to use the bridge, and the bridge benefits people. If you're going to cross that river, you don't need to know all the intricacies of the bridge in order to know how to use the bridge and that the bridge benefits you. And that's the same as this knowledge. You may not understand yet how this knowledge can benefit you, but just because it's there doesn't make it necessarily evil.
The and knowledge is sort of neutral, wouldn't you say, Dennis? The knowledge of 33,
it's exceedingly
for example,
neutral.
It's just knowledge
neutral.
Is power, you know?
It's neutral, but it's not, because it's gateways to a higher consciousness. So it's really not neutral. You know,
it's
providing
it's
gateways
knowledge,
to a higher
yeah.
consciousness.
You can use it for, you could use it to help you on your own spiritual path, to recognize these harmonies of the universe. And that's what I'm most interested in. But
right.
other people might be able to use this knowledge to control consciousness of the masses, or to gain the favor of heaven, if you will,
yes.
In their buildings and structures and so on.
And in this way, the knowledge becomes neutral at that level. When we compare the balance of black and white and the usage of it, yes, it becomes neutral. But to those who are being introduced to it, it's really not neutral. It's kind of, you know what I mean? It is, but it isn't, I guess, is how I'd like to word that.
You make of it what you will with your intent. So if your intent is to use this knowledge secretly for personal gain, I would say that would be sort of evil. But if you're going to use this knowledge and not keep it a secret and tell people about it and try to educate and uplift people with it, and expose things that are encoded, then that's probably going to do some good, I would think.
Yes. Going back to the Ellipse Park, we were talking about Ellipse Park earlier about the 366 megalithic yards, you call it. What is a megalithic yard?
Well, there's
I don't know what that is.
There was a Scottish engineer named Alexander Thom, and he surveyed hundreds, maybe thousands of megalithic sites in England, and I think also in France. Anyway, you can Google him. And he...
And who is that again?
Alexander Thom, T-H-O-M.
T-H-O-M, okay.
And he statistically figured out the unit of measure that was used in all of these megalithic structures. And he called that the megalithic yard. And that's 2.722 feet. And it's plus or minus 0.002 feet, something like that. And so Christopher Knight and Alan Butler figured out that this megalithic yard is used in a larger system that measures the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun. And they presented that in their book Civilization One, and also in the follow-up Before the Pyramids. And so I presented some of their research in my Volume 2 film, because I'm amazed by the beauty of that system and how it correlates with architecture and how it seems to be used in modern times, but without people's knowledge. It's there, but there was an architect who, you know, wrote about this in his architecture journal or something. This is totally unknown. And so why? My question is, why keep it a secret if you're going to, you know, create these temples? I think if it was me, I think I'd be proud of encoding something so grandiose in a design. And I'd want.
Well, Scott, I think. Yeah, Scott, I think the reason why I'll give you an answer for that. I'll actually give you a practical answer, is that you have competing forces in the universe. One is looking to build and grow, and they build and grow on these universal harmonics of which you're deciphering and sharing for people. And you have those that want to destroy it all, literally.
That's right.
And if you advertise it and publicize it, as we see now what's going on in Libya, we've unleashed this demon, and it's now destroying all of these ancient artifacts. You know, everywhere we see this chaos released, it goes, and what it really is seeking to target is this lost, this information, this knowledge. And so we must always guard, you know, we have to guard against this type of destruction.
I agree, Dennis. I think that there's a duality in the universe that runs all the way up through the different dimensions or hierarchies or however you want to look at it. And so there's good and evil, there's angels and demons, there's these forces that exist that are sort of influencing us, whether we're conscious of it or not.
Metadimensional. Transdimensional, metadimensional. And, you know, my research, Scott, I don't know if you've done what you found, but in the crafting of the language, you know, we're dealing with the shamanic energy, shamans, and how to go about naming things and things of this nature. But you had this transdimensional spiritual element that is not advertised in the West. We try to downplay the usage of shamanic type force.
Well, Dennis, when you get into gematria, don't you think when you really get into it deeply, you realize just how brilliant it is, and what the level of intelligence required to encode these things is beyond us. You know, it's beyond.
It's actually phenomenal. It's phenomenal when you understand how English is crafted, just how multidimensional and powerful this language really is.
And yet, it bears the mark of consciousness. It's not random.
It's not random. And, not even close.
So that leads you to speculate about non-physical beings that might be encoding these things.
Let me go ahead and state that I've got Dennis Fecho and Scott Onstott as my guests. And Dennis has a program, Inside the Eye Live, on Oracle Broadcasting on Saturdays. And Scott has Secrets in Plain Sight, where he's got Volume 1 and Volume 2 DVDs on his website, secretsinplainsight.com. Okay.
That's Scott.
I know.
You want to ask any questions? Sir? You've been very quiet on this.
I'm learning. So,
Dennis, I wanted to ask you if you ever see phi encoded in language.
I don't see phi, honestly. What I see is pi.
Just pi.
I see pi. English is based on pi.
Are you aware of the mathematical constant E? Because this is very close to the megalithic yard.
Fill everybody in, including me, because I don't deal in E. Actually, E has like a multidimensional use in the language, because when we tilt E on its side, in other words, if we take the E and we turn it to the right, and now we see that it forms like a fulcrum in the middle, and this becomes the scales of Ma'at.
Oh, interesting.
You know, well, when we look at Ma'at, that scale is really encoding the letter E. And, of course, M is 13, A is the scale, and AT is a 1-4, 13, 14, which then is pi. So basically you're being weighed against pi in this multidimensional code within the first 32 decimal digits of pi. And so E in our system is used to encode pi. But we do know that it's used in phi and in what you're going to discuss here. It just is not prevalent in the language.
Okay. Well, mathematicians use the lowercase letter e to symbolize this number 2.718 dot dot dot. It's a number that's a transcendental number like pi. In fact, the two transcendental numbers that people can name, they're just two, pi and e. And e is very important. It's the base of the natural logarithm, and it's used in science and engineering every day. It's also used in business. Sort of the maximum rate of maximum return on an investment is bound to E. In fact, Google, when they had their IPO in 2004, they announced their intention to raise exactly $1 billion. And now, 8 years later, they have more than $72 billion in assets.
Which is impressive. You know, another thing in the language, Scott, when you have a sudden awareness or an awakening, that is known as an E, a pi, and a PHA, or
epiphany.
A is one is I, or an epiphany. So in a sudden awareness or awakening is to become aware of E, pi, and phi.
Yeah, so I think E, pi, and phi, and the number 528 are all very important. And in my work, I find these all sort of equally, and that's why I ask whether you find other numbers other than pi in the language, and maybe the answer is it's all about pi, and that is enough, because pi is probably the most amazing number, just being the very simple concept, but elusive nevertheless.
Yeah, did you see the matrix?
Between
did
the circle you... and its diameter.
Correct. And, of course, the one being masculine and the zero being feminine. So this is the yin, the yang. But
yeah.
This is, you know, when you put it into sacred numbers, zero is feminine, one is masculine. Did you see The Matrix Reloaded?
I'm sure I did years ago.
Yeah, there was this scene in there about the Merovingian, and he's talking to Neo, and he says, our only purpose is to understand why. And, of course, why is the only question that is a letter.
Yeah, and it's – have you heard of the Pythagorean why, Dennis?
Fill me in,
no. Have you heard it referred to that way? The letter Y is like a fork in the road, a choice.
Yes.
The choice everyone has between working for yourself or working for others or light and dark or any duality. And so
Well, it's also though, it's the sacred triangle where three is Osiris, four is Isis, and five is, of course, the child, which is Horus. So therefore, 3 squared is letter I. Okay, that's the road. 4 squared is unique here because 4 squared, if I take 22, well, we use the numbers correlationally. 2 times 2 becomes 4, right? But this is the letter V, so that's the feminine. So if we take the masculine I and the feminine V, we create the child Y. So this is really a code for 3 squared times 4 squared equals 5 squared. And that's
and
what
the
word
four,
Y
four
is.
Triangle is so important in Egyptian thinking. And it's a key to the universe, really. It's you know, it's the key to this Earth-Moon diagram, which is so elegant. And it's hard to explain in words. When I, you know, I'd love to show you a picture, and you'd say, "Yeah." But
when you did Secrets in Plain Sight 2, did you bring up 3, 4, 5 triangle?
I think so. Yes. Let me just search. Yes, I showed that very diagram in the slope angles section, where I discuss John Michell's discovery back in 1973 that the 3-4-5 triangle was the key to unlocking a diagram that would depict the Earth and the Moon in their true proportions, and also show that give their actual diameters in miles, and it would also encode the distance between the Earth and the Moon. And it's kind of a, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words, so I'd have to tell you, I'd have to probably tell you a few thousand words to explain all of that. But suffice it to say that the 3-4-5 triangle is the key to unlocking this wisdom.
I agree. And it's, of course, known as the golden triangle. in Freemasonry, and it's instrumental. Even the word wise God, if we look at W, is 23, and we just reverse it. As we use numbers correlationally, W is 23, which reverse it 3 squared. H is, of course, the Greek transposition or the English transposition of pi, which is P, so that would be like 4 squared. Then Y being 5 squared. So even the word Y is encoded in 3, 4, 5.
Interesting. Yeah.
So, yeah, we see this in language everywhere, just as you're seeing it in architecture. Can you give, like, a great example of where you found 3, 4, 5 between three different points? Do you have any?
I can think of two examples. One is... in the King's Chamber within the Great Pyramid, there is a 3, 4, 5 triangle encoded in three dimensions. And I show this in Volume 2. So there's a 1-2 triangle on the floor of the chamber, and there's a 3, 4, 5 triangle sort of diagonal in the space. There's also another one connecting Phoenix, Arizona, with a small town in Texas called Denton, where I found all this amazing symbolism, with the Manitoba Legislative Building, which is at the center of North America.
Which is famous. Yeah, that's famous. Manitoba Building's famous.
That's right, and it's an incredible replica of Solomon's Temple, and there's a researcher named Frank Albo who has... written a book about it, and he gives tours there, I believe, in the summer, showing you the secrets encoded in that particular structure. But basically, there's a 3, 4, 5 triangle there connecting these points. Denton is due south of the Manitoba Legislative Building.
And so the three in this case is where?
West of it.
The three part of this triangle is from Phoenix to Denton.
I think the three is between Phoenix and Denton. The four,
and then the
would
four
be
is between Denton
and Manitoba, okay. In Winnipeg, and because the Manitoba Legislative Building is in Winnipeg, and then the hypotenuse would be from Winnipeg to Phoenix. And there's a 3, 4, 5 triangle in the Karnak. In France, where all those beautiful standing stones are. And I think it's Robin Heath who pointed that out in... I think it was his brother Richard. Richard Heath wrote a book called Sacred Number and the Origins of Civilization. And I believe it's in that book where he shows the 3, 4, 5 triangle, which is encoded in Karnak. So this kind of goes along with what I found, and lots of correlations between the earliest structures in Egypt and the Great Pyramid with the construction of Stonehenge. They happened at the same time, and there's a lot. They shared the same knowledge base, essentially. So I don't think there are any archaeological connections there, but there is certainly an intellectual one where these people really were essentially encoding the same diagrams in their building. So they had a much more advanced understanding of how the universe works in some ways than we do today.
Scott, we have a half hour to go here. Let's fast forward to contemporary time here. Let's go. We have, of course, New York, the old World Trade Center. Yeah, I hear a little bit of...
A very loud vehicle just went by. I don't know if you heard that. Can you repeat that?
Scott, the interesting thing is that you're on an island, right?
That's right.
And you don't even have any stoplights on your island.
No stoplights. We have a few stop signs, and not too many, though. So... yeah, it's kind of a joy driving around here. There isn't too much traffic.
You'd have no cops trying to pull people over for speeding?
We have no RCMP, as they call them here.
Oh, that is so cool, dude. You guys are actually free up there.
Yeah. You know, they they do come over in the summer a few times when there's a lot of tourists here.
Just to protect the tourists? Is that to protect the tourists from you guys or to protect you guys from the tourists?
I don't know. Yeah. It's good to be... I enjoy being at the edge of civilization.
Yeah, it sounds fabulous. You know, just the fact that you don't have to worry about being pulled over is a good thing.
Well, we have so many curves on our island that you really can't go very fast, even if you want to. You know, so if you're trying really hard, you might be able to get up to.
Do you have paved roads or is it all dirt?
What's that?
Do you have paved roads or too much?
No, it's what we affectionately call Mexican pavement.
Gravel.
Where it's not really paved, but what they do is they lay down a layer of tar, and then they put down a layer of gravel.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the cars are the steamroller. You pack it. And the road gets harder and harder over time.
And of course, everybody's got chip paint on the bottom of their car.
Yeah, every few years they just sort of repeat that process, and the road is improved.
I heard there's towns in Minnesota that are actually doing that. They're pulling up all the pavement and they're going to this style because the traffic doesn't warrant the pavement, meaning the asphalt, and it's just too expensive.
Well, apparently asphalt is super expensive, you know.
And it's expensive to maintain.
Yeah. Well, the problem we have here is asphalt has to be hot. So they put it on a barge, and by the time they get it here, and by the time they can unload it and put it on the road, they can only do a very small section. So it's just not practical for our remoteness here, you know.
That's fascinating.
Although the neighboring island has a beautiful paved road system. So they're close enough to civilization to have all of those amenities.
So by the time the barge gets to you, it's just too cold and it's too expensive to have a heated barge.
Yeah, and we only have 1,000 people here, so let's not bother, you know. I guess they figured economically, it's just not.
So you guys are cruising around in road bikes. You're not like on these super high-speed cruising bikes.
Well, you know, we generally drive around in our car. But I also have an electric scooter that I use to go to the post office. And strangely enough, its maximum speed is 33 kilometers an hour. I just had to laugh when I'm like on the straightaway. I'm like, this thing just goes exactly 33. So another hilarious coincidence there that just pops up in daily life.
Scott, we have a little less than half an hour to go. I want to go back to Secrets in Plain Sight, Volume 2, and just share some of the information in there. One of the dreidel points, let's go Section 3 here. You call 20 plus 4. What's up with 20 plus 4?
20 plus 4. Do you mean 24, the number 24?
Well, you know, I'm just looking at the file name. It's maybe it's 24.
Oh.
Your file name says 20 plus 4. Is that 24? Well, of course it equals 24.
I'm just not sure exactly.
Because you're talking about the Fibonacci sequence, okay? You start off with the Fibonacci sequence.
Okay. Yes, you are talking about 24 then. The Fibonacci sequence is a really beautiful and simple concept where you take a number, let's say you start with 1, and then you add it to the... You take another 1, and you add those together, and you get 2. So the sequence goes 0, 1, 1, 2. And then the next number is 2 plus 1, that's 3. And the next number is 3 plus, how does it go? It goes, the Fibonacci sequence is 0, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, and so on.
Correct.
The rule is that you add...
I'm going to give you a very high grade for this, okay? You're doing great.
I don't think I'm saying it very well, but it's really a very simple rule. You just add the previous 2 terms in the sequence to get the next term.
Right.
And
so
it goes on and on.
2
like
plus
forever.
3 is 5. 5 plus 3 is 8. 8 plus 5 is 13. 13 plus 8 is 21. 20 plus 13 is 34, etc.
So you go, so on and so forth. But so what, right? Well, it turns out that lots of things are built using the Fibonacci sequence. like take a sunflower.
And it makes, by the way, Scott, it makes sense because it's a very harmonic, beautiful number. And of course, architecture being all about creating value and usage, but also beauty, you're going to want to use beautiful numbers.
Yes. And the Fibonacci sequence encodes phi, because if you divide any two adjacent terms, you get a number that's close to phi. And as you go through the sequence, the further out you go, you get higher numbers, and then you divide those, and you get even closer to phi. So essentially, phi is like the ideal number that the Fibonacci sequence is trying to converge upon. And the amazing thing that I noticed, I came across some research that if you take the digital roots of the Fibonacci sequence, the roots repeat with a period of 24. And so 24 is like this number which is behind the whole sequence, if you will.
And so you know, I've heard this also.
Yeah,
I've heard this also, and there's early Baconian ciphers that were based on a 24-digit alphabet as opposed to our current 26, which is interesting. I haven't broke it down because I deal in 26, but yeah, this 24 is very instrumental in understanding many of the early Baconian ciphers.
Well, and even going back further, the ancient Egyptians actually had an alphabet. This is not very well known, but they did have an alphabet that was composed of 24 hieroglyphic symbols. And they're called uniliterals. I find that that kind of resonates with this concept here.
Now, and we put this back. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say that the way that you find this repetition is by finding the digital roots, and that is known by many different terms like Pythagorean addition or Theosophical addition. How do you say that, Dennis? When you take the number 13 and you reduce it to 4,
we call that a reduced ordinal value.
Reduced ordinal value. Okay,
I call it
a digital root. It's the same. Everybody has a different term for it.
Yeah, the gematria term, Kabbalistic term, is reduced ordinal value.
Okay.
So it's actually, have a term for that.
The reduced ordinal values of the Fibonacci sequence repeat with a period of 24. And then I also show that prime numbers also follow this cycle of 24. And this was from a book written by Peter Plichta. He's a physicist and a chemist. And he discovered that there's a profound symmetry which is observed in the prime numbers if you array them around a circle that has 24 divisions. And then when you get to the 25th, you make another ring. And then you go around again to 48. And you just keep going like that. And it turns out that all the prime numbers are on 8 of the rays, 8 of the 24 rays that radiate out from this circle. And he discovered that there's this order within prime numbers based on 24. And so that correlates here with what we found about the Fibonacci sequence and phi, and also with Ed Lead Skalman's mysterious rotor artifact in Coral Castle, which has 24 magnets arranged in a ring. And so I'm just showing how all these different systems come together, and then you have to ask yourself, why do we have 24 hours in a day? You know, that's arbitrary. You could chop up time any way you like, but when you chop it up into 24 hours, then you get 86,400 seconds in a day, and then that correlates with the sun, because the sun is 864,000 miles in diameter. And so these things are all sort of, they all fall together. They all fit in a hyperdimensional system, which is sort of beyond us in terms of seeing how it all comes together. But when I come across these things, I try to present them in a coherent way where you can see all the connections. Do you find anything in your work about 24, Dennis?
No. Honestly, no.
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 Well, maybe that's because English isn't based on 24, and we...
Correct. It's not.
We
it's based
can't
on
work
pi.
With it that way. Yeah.
It's based on pi. 24 would be x. Okay, it would be the letter x, but the x, of course, is just the feminine on the top and the masculine on the bottom. What's interesting about the letter x, everybody, is if you take the upper part of x, that's the number 7 here in the Middle East, and if you take the lower part, it's number 8. Don't know this. I mean, there are significances there that I could get into, but let me just go fast because actually we're running out of time already, Scott. Let's go back to something more contemporary people can relate to, and I think that's the World Trade Center. You've of course uncovered quite a lot in your research, of course, aggregating this research from other people about the World Trade Center. For instance, the center, the 9 planters, 36 rays, 33 tables, for instance.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Now you're talking about the original World Trade Center.
The original World Trade Center, WTC 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
That's right. And so it has all this number symbolism in it. And also I noticed that the proportions of the Twin Towers match the proportions in the Bible about the pillars of Boaz and Jacob, you know, the two Masonic pillars of sun and moon. Mm-hmm. They're described in the Bible, and the proportions of the Twin Towers match them.
It was also a processional code, Scott.
Okay, how does that go?
Because it was 110 stories mirrored upon each other. So we have the sequence 11011. Now, if you go back to the Bible, there's something called the achromatic cipher. And in an achromatic cipher, they're basically encoding in the parable the actual mathematical formula. It's kind of like a word problem in math if you're familiar with your elementary school. And it's found in Genesis 3:14, which is pi, and it talks about the serpent. And it says, "Cursed are you, and because you have done this, dust you shall eat all the, onto your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life." And because, and we're dealing here with an achromatic cipher. And in this achromatic cipher, everything is based on summation. So if we look at 1 plus 2, it's going to equal 3, which is then, of course, we take the 1 and the 3, and we make the letter B. 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 is D, and we use the 1 and the 0 to create a D and so forth. But if we carry it out to 11, it equals 66, and now we're mirroring the dice.
And you saw how I used dice in Volume 2.
Yeah.
Let me finish this real quick then.
So if we take 11011, we have to go to the belly, because if we have two dice showing, which is snake eyes, which is the serpent, what's on the belly of the beast or the belly of the serpent but the two sixes? Okay, so we just transpose the 11011 to 66066, multiply it out, and that is, of course, the half processional time of the equinox, or the precession of the equinoxes.
It's amazing how these things are connected.
So, yeah, this clearly was a connection there. So now go ahead with your point.
So I was just saying that in Volume 2, I show a visualization of those two dice that you described with the, in the footprints of the original Twin Towers. Now it's a memorial called Reflecting Absence. And it looks to me like snake eyes. You know, it has a small square inside a larger square. And so I showed two dice with the ones down in that, and then you see the sixes on top. And, the sum of the numbers, 66 is connected with 33 and 11, because if you look at a pair of sixes, you can look at them in different ways. You can say, well, a six is like two towers, like two 11s. You know, you have 11, 11, or if you turn it sideways, you count three dots across, and then another three dots, and so you can read that as 33, and the other dice is 33. It's interesting because 33.33 times 33.33 rounds to 11, 11. So we have this sort of connection again.
Wasn't it dedicated on 9/11 too? Was that? Was just with the Pentagon? Because somewhere I thought that it was also dedicated on a 9/11.
I'm not sure when it was dedicated, but I know it's supposed to open this year on 9/11. They're not quite done with it. The whole national 9/11 memorial there.
Okay.
But I know that in 2011, on 9/11, they turned on the those big spotlights. Remember that are in the shape of the Twin Towers?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that? It's called... But there was a name for it. But they used 88 lights, I believe. And that was a very interesting number because, there are 88 constellations in the heavens. And there's 88 keys on a piano. And the new...
And if you take the sum of 1 to 8, it's 36 times 36. Ooh. Which is 6 times 6 times 6 times 6.
Yeah.
So all these numbers, they're all correlationally put together. And once you start to see them, really reality changes for you. And I think that's the important part of this research, is it allows you to go beyond the very simplistic, let's just say, education that the powers that be, as it's being called in the conspiracy world, would like you to stay in. It gives you a pathway out. It's an intellectual pathway. But it's not per se. It is a spiritual journey, but it's a spiritual journey through an intellectual study of the universe. Is this what you found, Scott? I mean, that's what I found.
On different levels, you know, there's so much that's encoded in these prominent buildings and structures that isn't evident to the mainstream consciousness. And
what's,
so,
what's going on? Yeah, what's going on right now, real quick, with world financial centers?
We have two very similar buildings. One is the building in New York City, which is the American Express headquarters, and it was designed by Cesar Pelli. And also he designed another very similar building in the city of London called One Canada Square. And incidentally, One Canada Square was originally designed to be 864 feet high, but it had to be reduced down to 770 feet, and the reason was it was in the flight path of the City of London Airport.
small problem there.
Small little detail there.
Everybody flying in has to make a short detour.
Has a floor area of 111,000 square meters. And this number sort of ties in with the World Trade Center, because it had 110 floors or 111 floors if you count the roof.
And another interesting thing is you have the American Express Tower to the Cleopatra's Needle.
Yeah, and I think that's 33, is it 33,000?
333,000 inches. Yeah, right. 333,000 inches.
Yeah, Mark Gray discovered that. And there's also inside the American Express headquarters, there's a monument called 11 Tiers, and it has an 11-sided piece of quartz suspended over an 11-sided granite fountain.
And it has 11-11 again.
11, it has 11 droplets of water dropping in the fountain all the time. And
what's the relationship with what's real quick, the relationship of the Vatican obelisk to the Temple of Debod in Spain?
Okay, that is, the Temple of Debod is in Madrid, and that was a temple that was originally south of Aswan. And when they built the dam, they had to move it. They gave it to Madrid. And that temple is a linear complex in Madrid. And if you draw a line through it and extend it across the globe, it goes right to the Vatican obelisk, and it bisects St. Peter's Basilica, and it goes through one of the windrows markers there surrounding the obelisk.
What was the Temple of Debod?
What'd you say?
What was the Temple of Debod? No, what?
What was it?
Yeah.
I think it probably was a Temple of Isis, I'm guessing, because I know the Temple of Dendur, which is very similar, was also south of Aswan, and it was moved to New York City. It's in the Met, and it was a temple of Isis. There's also another temple of Eleusia, and that was moved to Turin. And again, it, if you draw a line between it and the Vatican obelisk, it, the line goes right through one of the windrose markers surrounding the obelisk. And so these locations are seemingly planned. You know, they're lining up. And the Vatican obelisk is sort of like an axis of the world. It's a world tree, an omphalos, if you will. It's the male aspect, and it's surrounded by Bernini's enclosure, which creates St. Peter's Square, and there are 153 statues on top of that, and 153 is a really important number. It's the number, if you take the square root of 153, you get the number of full moons in a year, the number of lunation cycles in a year, that is.
Really?
So it's tied in with the moon.
What is that number?
12.368.
12.368 is the square root of 153?
Yeah.
It's also the sum of 1 to 17.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, the sum of 1 to 26 is 351. It's inverse, or a palindrome.
It's also the number of fish that was caught in a passage in the Bible, which has really puzzled scholars. They're like, why do they say there's 153 fish? Like, who cares? But I think it's there because it's a code for the moon. And so,
and the moon, of course, Scott, the moon, of course, Scott, is feminine, regarded as feminine typically, traditionally in the occult world. And the letter Q, like thank you, is the fertilized egg.
Fertilized egg, interesting.
From which all life comes, you know, so thank you, because without the Q, you have no life. So thank you, you know, it's like thank you. Thank this letter. Thank the 153.
And so obelisks are usually accompanied with a feminine symbol.
Correct.
In the case of the Vatican obelisk, it's the 153 statues. In many other obelisks in Rome, they are flanked by fountains, which are a feminine symbol of water.
Mm-hmm.
But you always have this duality, you know. The male and the female energies are balanced.
Correct. And this is just how we do it in the West. And, of course, you'd have to, if you go to Korea or China, there's a whole different type of study, but at the end of the day, it's still encoding the same thing. You know, we just do it in numbers and this logic and reason system, but then they're going to do it a different way in the Taoist system and a bit different way in the Confucian system. But I think the real lesson here is that the duality is what's important. And if we focus too much on this one idea, this one this, and we forget the other half, which is the zero, we lose sight of reality in a very clear way. I think
we need to balance the light and the dark, if you will. I mean, in a way, it's like balancing your left and right hemispheres of your brain internally. You know, to be healthy and whole, you need to have balance.
I agree. I'm just going through some of your work, you know, just a real fascinating couple of insights. You just have a few minutes left, but Aswan Dam in Egypt.
Are you referring to the one surrounding that structure?
Well, Aswan Dam, 111 meters high.
Yeah.
The maximum.
It holds back 111 cubic kilometers of water.
And the maximum.
The water flow down at a maximum of 11,000 cubic meters per second. And I put the links on that slide in the movie.
Yeah, fascinating.
They're, you know, abbreviated, shortened URLs so you can type them in. And I couldn't believe it when I found that information. I'm like, wait, it's really holding back 111 cubic kilometers of water? Why couldn't it be 113? You know, I mean, everything
right.
is converging on ones there.
And maybe, again, that's just this hyperdimensional being encoding this information. And I think the real point to remember here, Scott, is that humanity is part of a larger universe. Okay? This is my view. And that it's part of a larger consciousness, and it's not just humanity. But we're a very small piece of a very large universe. And life and the universe is teeming. literally teeming. Now we have our solar system. We have in your slide regarding 24, you talked about this center of mass between Sirius and our solar system.
That's right. I presented some of binary companion theory of Walter Cruttenden at the Binary Research Institute. And he talks about how our solar system is actually in motion, and it's moving relative to the Sirius system. And he has shown that the data really works out very well to show that we are actually in a binary system with the Sirius system. We are orbiting each other. We're orbiting our common center of mass. And he's calculated that the period of that cycle is 24,000 years. And so, again, this ties in with 24. And it's just incredible how these harmonies converge on these numbers. 24 hours in a day, 24,000 year, great year. And he shows that people have calculated the traditional figure of 25,920 years is calculated when the Earth's precessional rate is slower, when we're at a different point in our orbit. It looks like we process 1 degree every 72 years.
And which is where we're at now?
No, that was where we were at sometime in the past, a couple thousand years ago. And now the precessional rate is actually speeding up. And he's calculated that the average rate is 66.6 years per degree. So
how does this link to the music? Scott, how does this link to the musical scale?
To the musical scale?
Yes.
We have one octave is 12 notes in the chromatic scale in the Western music. And if you have one octave up and one octave down, you have 24 notes. And you have, it's just like the Earth, where one half is facing the sun and the other half is dark. So you have sort of the music of the Earth is, you could play an octave up and an octave down, and then you would have, and come back to where you started again, and that would be sort of like the hours of a day and a night. So our music, you know, harmonizes with this concept of 24 also.
Well, gentlemen, I think we're coming to the end of the program this evening, and it's been very interesting. I would have never figured myself being able to be caught up in a program around numbers, but it has been great. Scott, and I would love to be able to do this again sometime, and Dennis as well. And I have to thank you for coming on the program. Did you have some closing thoughts, either one of you?
Scott, give out your website and all the information besides the price.
All right. So you can check out my work. I have two movies there, volumes 1 and 2, at secretsinplainsight.com. And I have a blog there as well with really lots of information, and that's all free. So check it out.
And your YouTube channel, Scott?
My YouTube channel is YouTube/secretsinplainsight, and you can go there as well. That's, embedded in my website, so there's no reason really to go directly to YouTube.
So just go to secretsinplainsight.com.
Exactly. Okay. And thank you, Dennis, for the conversation. It's been very interesting.
And
Appreciate
Dennis,
you coming on.
And Dennis, your website or your program is Inside the Eye Live on Oracle Broadcasting.
Yeah, I have two websites, Melody. It's,
okay.
Illuminatusobserver.blogspot.com. That's Illuminatusobservor with an O. .blogspot.com. This is really one of the finest hermetic Kabbalah blogs, really in all of blogdom. You won't find anything as unique as this out there on the World Wide Web. And, of course, visit InsideTheEyeLive.com for all the latest program and information regarding my show on the Oracle Broadcasting Network, which precedes you, Melody.
That's right.
Every Saturday morning.
Okay, I want to thank you gentlemen again, and I hope to do it again. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
Bye.
Okay, goodbye.